Scripture readings, 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verses 6 through 12, from the New American Standard. Now these things happened as examples for us, that we should not crave evil things as they also craved, and do not be adulterers as some of them were, as is written. The people sat down to eat, drink, and stood up to play. Nor let us act immorally as some of them did, and 23,000 fell in one day. Nor let us try the Lord as some of them did, and were destroyed by the serpents. Nor grumbled as some of them did, and they were destroyed by the destroyer. Now these things happened to them as an example, and they were written for our instructions, upon which the ends of the ages have come. Therefore, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall.
Well, good morning. We have been studying through the early characters of the Bible, separately considering Adam, Eve, Abel, Cain, Cain's descendant Lamech, and of course spending a couple of lessons on Noah, not only his righteousness and faith and obedience by which he saved mankind through the flood, but also his sin after the flood and the curse that fell on Ham for his participation in that sin. There's then left only one character who is given more than just a name between Noah and Abraham, and that is the man Nimrod, whom we can read about in Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 through 12. Genesis chapter 10, verses 8 through 12. Now Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel and Erech and Akkad and Calneh in the land of Shinar. From that land he went forth into Assyria and built Nineveh and Rehoboth-ir and Calah. Here we talk about a man of some considerable importance, Nimrod, the man who built Babylon and Nineveh. And if you know anything about the Old Testament, you know Babylon and Nineveh, the two great enemies of Israel. And these verses, when they talk about Nimrod, seem at first to be positive in the modern translations, suggesting Nimrod as a mighty man and a great builder and a great king. But there are a couple of reasons why we may suppose that these are not really positive things that are being said about Nimrod. For one, this account immediately follows the events of chapter 9 and the curse on Ham's son Cana. And, of course, Cush, who is the father of Nimrod, was one of the sons also of Ham. And you may note, too, that Nimrod's descendants live in the land of Shinar, or in your Western Civ text, Sumner. And here we have Babylon and Nineveh among the cruelest of the nations in the history of mankind, and certainly the pinnacle of cruelty in the Old Testament. The immediate aftermath of this is in Babylon, or Babel, where the Tower of Babel is built. And clearly that's a negative kind of a circumstance. It looks to me like the purpose of this narrative from Adam through to Abraham is really to do two things. You'll remember that it is Moses who is writing these things under the instruction of the Holy Spirit, and he's writing them for the nation of Israel as they're leaving Egypt and going back into the land of Canaan. And there they're going to have to drive out these people that are before them, and there they're going to come under the influence of and in conflict with the other wicked kingdoms of the world, particularly, ultimately, Assyria and Babylon. And so God is instructing Moses to warn them about the differences that exist between them and those other nations, and how those other nations got to be so wicked. The second purpose of this account, not so specifically for Israel, but for you and me, is to give us an understanding about how wicked man is. So wicked, Genesis chapter 6 tells us, that every thought, every intent of his heart was evil only always. so wicked that God wiped man off of the face of the earth with a flood, saving only Noah and his family because of Noah's righteousness in his generation. And even after God has purged the earth, it seems, of sin, and we have only the righteous Noah and his family left, sin almost immediately shows up again in the drunkenness of Noah and the sin of Ham. In fact, God can't save man by a flood. He can't save man by fire. He can't save man through man's own efforts. Ultimately, it's going to require Jesus Christ to come and to die on the cross for our sakes. And we need to be convinced of that before we're willing to hear the gospel story as good news. And here's the record of this kind of wickedness. God cleanses the earth, gives them a chance to start over, and they're wicked almost immediately, and they continue to get worse and worse and worse. And Nimrod is a part of this story. Note the symmetry, too, of what's happened here in this account from Adam to the time of Abraham. The progression from Adam into Caleb and Seth. Caleb, who is the wicked person, Lamech, who follows in his footsteps. And Seth, who replaces really Abel, who was killed by Caleb. And Seth, who is the father of then Noah and the father of Abraham and the father of Jesus. And after Noah, you think all of the descendants of Cain are destroyed. But no, not here any longer, but we have the idea of sin that emerges even in the descendants of Noah with Ham and with Cana and with Cush and with Nimrod. The story of the Bible really is the story of two kinds of people. There are those people who belong to God and those people who refuse to belong to God. There's a kind of a symmetry between Adam and the flood and Noah, and then Noah to Abraham and the promise of Jesus coming into the world. There's more of this symmetry indicated here in Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4. Genesis chapter 6 and verse 4, before the flood, we read about the Nephilim who were on the earth, the giants, some of the translations give it, but not just giants in the sense of giants, but giants in terms of some kind of evil. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and afterwards, we're told, the Nephilim were on the earth before the flood, and the Nephilim were on the earth after the flood. Though evil was on the earth before the flood, it was on the earth after the flood. And we're told about these Nephilim that they were mighty men of old, of renown. That's one of these mighty men, Nimrod. Look at the verse here about Nimrod in Genesis chapter 10. And verses 8 and 9, Cush became the father of Nimrod. He became a mighty one on the earth, a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it said that Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord, the beginning of his kingdom, Babylon and Nineveh in particular. The name Nimrod literally means rebel or the rebel. And if we think about Nimrod as a rebel, against whom did he rebel? Well, he certainly rebelled against God. He maybe rebelled against Noah and the strict kind of life that Noah and Abraham and all of those people of God live. But he is a rebel, and he is in some ways the first rebel. His name is the rebel. Delitzsch, among others, presumes that this biblical Nimrod, who is the founder of Syria, of Nineveh, and the founder of Babylon, surely must show up in history somewhere, in the history of those, in the literature of those cultures. And he finds him in Marduk, the king of the Assyrians, which is linguistically the same as Nimrod. But of course, all that's speculation. What is not speculation is that he is called the rebel, and that he produces, and we're told very decidedly that, the two most rebellious kingdoms, the two most evil kingdoms in the history of the Old Testament, Babylon and Nineveh. He's called the mighty hunter. And of course, we might read that and say, you know, what's wrong with being a hunter? What's wrong with being a great hunter if you're going to be a hunter? But one of the things that you may note is that he becomes so famous as a hunter that becomes a proverb that they would say of others, he's like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before God. He has a reputation that becomes a proverb. And a reputation becomes a proverb among which people? The people in Sumner, the people of Babylon, and the people of Assyria, the people of Nineveh. What we're finding is that among those kinds of ungodly and those kinds of fierce people, that the name Nimrod comes to stand for being a mighty hunter. And I think we might very well take the sense in the way in which the term is most frequently used in the Old Testament. When we say mighty, it's not just talking about somebody that's great. It's not just talking about somebody who's strong. When mighty is used of men as opposed to used of God, it almost always talks about those who are mighty in war. Mighty, not just in their hunting of animals, but mighty in their hunting of men. That's the way it's used in Genesis chapter 6 when it's used about the Nephilim. That's the way it seems to suggest when it talks about the very next thing is that Nimrod is the first king we ever hear of in the Bible. We don't hear about kingdoms or kings until we hear about Nimrod. And he expanded his kingdom to all of these great cities of the east. He expanded his kingdom from Babylon. That wasn't enough. He expanded his kingdom into Nineveh. We're talking about a man who is a mighty hunter, not just of animals, but a mighty hunter of men, and who brings into the world this kind of tyranny that exists in Assyria and in Babylon. Well, of course, the thing that kind of sets us off to think it's positive is when it says he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Before the Lord sounds like just a preposition. But in Hebrew, it is really literally the word for face. He was a mighty hunter. Some translated in the sight of the Lord. Some translated a mighty hunter in the whole world to give it some kind of innocuous sense. But he was a mighty hunter in the face of the Lord. And half the time we see that phrase used in the Bible, it's negative. It is not just something that God sees neutrally, is not something that God approves of. Very rarely is the expression used that way. But it is in the face of God, it is in opposition to God, it is in spite of God that he is a mighty hunter. And when they say in Babylon, and they say in Nineveh, and they say Nimrod, a mighty hunter in the face of God, they're not saying somebody who follows God, who God looks on with approval. They're talking about somebody who is a rebel in the spirit of Nimrod, who was the rebel. They're talking about somebody who is a mighty oppressor of men in opposition to God. He's a king, and he introduces imperialism into the world. And the kind of imperialism that leads to the tyranny and the cruelty of Assyria and Babylon. And if we wanted to really, I think, be true to the spirit of this whole passage, and we wanted to continue to be true to the words that are used here, a better translation of this passage might be, Cush begat Nimrod, and he began to be a tyrant on the earth. And he was a tyrannical hunter of men in opposition to the Lord. And thus it is said, Nimrod, the tyrannical opponent of God. He is the rebel. And he demonstrates to us the kind of rebellion that God just could not wipe off the face of the earth by the flood. He represents the kind of sin that lives in not only the kingdoms of men, but in the heart of men that cannot be cured by punishment, not by flood, not by fire, but can only be cured by the love of God and Jesus Christ and his sacrifice. You think about this man Nimrod, and what does he represent to us? He represents, first of all, what his name says, the rebel. He represents rebellion and rebellion really against God. Proverbs 17 and verse 11 reminds us a rebellious man seeks only to do evil. That's the thing that defines this man, is he's a rebel. He's going to do what people don't want him to do. He's going to do what God doesn't want him to do. And Proverbs 24 and verse 21 reminds us, do not join with the rebellious. And you think what happened here? Nimrod got practically the entire world to join with him. The majority of the world, Babylon and Nineveh, Assyria, are rebels against God. And that's because rebellion really is in the heart of men. Nimrod was a rebel. Some ways, maybe he disregarded the lessons that he'd learned from his grandfather, Noah. And how soon it is that people forget the lessons that they've learned from the past. We say frequently, those who don't learn from history are doomed to repeat the mistakes of history. And it's clearly true that the same kind of evil that existed before the flood and brought about the flood begins to exist very shortly thereafter on the earth in the people, particularly of Ham, and particularly in the people of Nimrod. And I think probably when we start thinking about Syria and Nineveh and this kind of rebellion, you know, that seems pretty far distant from us. But if we really think about it, we know the temptation to rebel against God, to be arrogant in the face of God, in our own hearts, well, if not in our own hearts, certainly in the words of other people around about us. There are those who will say, when something hasn't gone to suit them, when they've suffered some kind of reversal, or when they've suffered some kind of loss, when some personal tragedy has occurred, how can God be so cruel, they will say. And they will go further and say, it is not a good God who lets evil like this exist in the world. That's the very spirit of rebellion that leads to those who want to be independent and arrogantly mighty in the face of God. People will say, a God of love would never judge people to eternity in hell. That's not a God that I would worship. That's rebellion. They will say, the Bible's an evil book filled with horrible things. They publish those books all the time as if it is something extraordinary. I saw one advertised just the other day. 1,000 things about the Bible you never knew. And those 1,000 things are the most taken out of context, the most horrible things you could imagine. When they talk about the imprecatory Psalms, when they talk about the Deuteronomic law, when they talk about the descriptions of hell that Jesus provides, these are horrible things, they say. Who would ever believe such a book? Or they will say, Christians are really just prudes and narrow-minded bigots. And what we really need to do is eliminate that kind of bigotry and that kind of prejudice from the world, and it would be a better place. The only real sin is the sin of intolerance. It's what people say today, and it's almost exactly, I think, what they were saying in the days after the flood. You can almost hear the words of rebellion in those days, whether these were spoken by Nimrod or by others. You know it's in the heart of mankind. How could a loving God have drowned all those people in a flood? It just doesn't make sense to me. I don't believe that God wants us to live in such a shabby, dirty way as shepherds. That's the way they thought about Abraham, who traveled back and forth through the land of Canaan, never possessing any of it, and building altars everywhere he went. We are capable of greater things than this if we will set our narrow prejudices aside. We can build a tower to the skies. We can protect ourselves against anything God throws against us if we can build a tower tall enough. He'll never drown us again. We're smarter than those old-fashioned people like Noah, who spent all those hundreds of years building an ark and then continues to build altars to the God that flooded him and made him have to build an ark. really, there's a little difference between the spirit of rebellion today and the spirit of rebellion that exists in that old world, the spirit of rebellion in the heart and the mind of the rebel, Nimrod. That's why I had Bill read 1 Corinthians chapter 10. These things happen as example to us. Sometimes we talk about the power of example, and we very frequently, and maybe rightly so, focus on the positive side of that, the positive side of example. And when we talk about someone as an example, we usually are holding them up as a paragon, and that's really good if we can find those kinds of examples. But the power of example is on the other side too. And the Bible very frequently lays that out for us. Look what they did and what happened to them. You don't want that to happen to you, so don't do what they did. These things happen as an example to us. And in particular, the conclusion is, let him who thinks he stands take heed lest he fall. Don't be proud. Don't be arrogant against God. Don't be rebellious like these people were. And in keeping with that kind of sense of rebellion that I think I see here in Nimrod, there's the idea of being independent of God. There's the idea of power. He was, after all, a mighty hunter. And he turned that power, whether it was rightly used in the first place for hunting animals, he turned that power into building a kingdom for himself, a huge kingdom. He became a tyrant like all the tyrants after him who suppose that they're above all other men and can control all other men and even think they're above God and independent of God. I'll tell you this, no matter how mighty we may be, whether it's in the skill of hunting or whether it's in the skill of programming computers, whatever our skill is, no matter how great we may be about that, we are not greater than God, or greater even than other men. We, all of us, are going to end up in the front of God's judgment seat. Nimrod himself, Nimrod the mighty hunter in the face of God, Nimrod the founder of Babylon, Nimrod the founder of Assyria, will end up in the front and before God's judgment seat, and every one of them, every one of us will bow the knee, fall at Jesus' feet, and proclaim that he is Lord in that great and terrible day of the Lord. Power is just not going to be sufficient or adequate when we have to do with him with whom we have to do. And that's not all. The spirit of rebellion is not just a spirit of wanting power and independence. The spirit of rebellion is about wanting glory. It's about wanting fame. Nimrod wanted glory. He wasn't content with building Babylon. Now, you just think about that. Babylon, the great city, Babylon. Babylon, who is the envy of the ancient world. That wasn't enough for Nimrod. He left there and he went out and he built Nineveh. He wanted glory. He wanted more. And the need for this glory infested the nations that he built. We read about that in Genesis chapter 11 when we read about the building of the Tower of Babel, which gives its name to Babylon. Genesis chapter 11 and verse 4. They said, "Come, let us build for ourselves a city and a tower whose top will reach into the heavens, and let us make for ourselves a name. Otherwise, we will be scattered abroad over the face of the earth." And I think if we read it correctly, it's Nimrod who established Babylon, and this is the origin of the establishment of Babylon. So we're reading about Nimrod here who says, "Come, let us make a name for ourselves. Let's build a tower, reach into heaven." I don't know exactly what they thought about reaching into heaven. I don't know whether they supposed they could build all the way up to God's throne or whether they supposed they could build it high enough the flood waters would never wipe them out again if God sent a flood on them. But they wanted to do something that was glorious, that would make a name for themselves. Nothing wrong probably with building a tower. Nothing wrong with establishing civilization. But by making a name for themselves, We get the idea they were forgetting God's name, or maybe worse than forgetting God's name, they wanted to eclipse God's name with their own name. They wanted to glorify themselves. They didn't want to depend on God. They wanted to be independent of God. They wanted to have it their own way. And you know what happened as a result of that, wanting to make a name for themselves and building a tower all the way to the heavens. As a result of that, they brought upon themselves the confusion of languages, which seems in some ways a relatively innocuous kind of story when we tell it to our children in the little children's class. Seems relatively innocuous even when we just read it. But you think about the damage that is done in the world today because of the different languages that we employ. 6,000 different languages spoken by significant groups of people around the world today, and thousands of others in which they can't understand one another that are spoken by just small groups of people around the world. Think of the damage, not just the struggle of trying to learn a different language, not just the confusion when you go to another country and you can't ask them where the nearest restroom is, not just that kind of confusion, but the kind of hostility results, anger and violence, because we don't understand one another and can't understand one another. And that resulted because they thought they were greater than God. They wanted to make a name for themselves. Noah, you see, made an ark in order to obey God, and by doing so, he saved himself and his family. Nimrod made a name for himself, but even though he made a name for himself as a mighty hunter, that wasn't enough. He had to make a name for himself as a founder of kingdoms, Babylon, and then that wasn't enough. He had to make for himself a bigger, further, larger kind of reputation by building Nineveh. And that's the problem with ambition and the desire for glory. It is never enough. Proverbs 27 verse 20, we read in class Wednesday night, hell and destruction are never full, so is the eyes of man never satisfied. Covetousness, the desire for glory, is never going to be satisfied. We never get enough. That lesson is so obvious that even Dr. Seuss tries to teach us that lesson in Yertle the Turtle. The turtles were all happy. They had no need. They were happy indeed until Yertle the Turtle, the king of them all, decided the kingdom he ruled was too small. And he piled them up so he could stand on the top, and he said, I'm king of all that I can see, the things that I rule. And of course, it's silly, cow, mule, cat. But it isn't enough. I can do better yet, he said. Pile them higher still. And he looked and he said, I see a mile. I can see them all. But while he was shouting, he saw with surprise that the moon of the evening was starting to rise up over his head in the darkening sky. And what is that? Shouted Yertle. Say, what is that thing that dares to be higher than Yertle the king? I'll not allow it. I'll go higher still. I'll build my throne higher. I can and I will. And of course, Yertle ended up back in the mud. Because it's always that way. If you like a little high-toned literature, Shelley's poem about Ozymandias tells exactly the same story. I met a traveler from an antique land who said, two vast and trunkless legs of stone stand in the desert, and near them on the sand, half sunk, a shattered visage lies, whose frown and wrinkled lip and sneer of cold command tells that the sculptor well those passions read. The hand that mocked them, the heart that fed, and on the pedestal these words appear. My name is Ozymandias, the King of Kings. Look on my works, you mighty in despair. And nothing beside remains. Round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare, the lone and level sands stretch far away. Ambition, the desire for glory, the desire to have a reputation, to be mighty in the world, to be independent, it is bottomless. It is never satisfied. No matter how much a person achieves, they are never going to be satisfied with that. That's the spirit of rebellion. That is the spirit of Nimrod. And he really tells us a story, not just about himself, but about the heart of man. And the Holy Spirit has inspired Moses to use this as a part of the broader story that he's telling about the way the world is constructed. There has always been, since the days of Cain, two nations of men. And they're summed up in these generations. The generations of Adam devolve into the generations of Cain and the generations of Seth. And out of Seth, we get Noah and Abraham and the Christ. And out of Cain, we get Lamech. But even when we purify and we take Noah and his family alone, we have again the two nations of mankind. We have the descendants there from Shem, leading to Abraham and the Christ. And we have the descendants of Ham and Cana and Cush and Nimrod. Two nations that are opposed to one another. And all of this is summed up in the book of Revelation. Jerusalem on the one hand and Babylon on the other. Jerusalem is the city of David, the city of the Messiah. Of course, in the book of Revelation, Jerusalem is symbolic and it's purified. And we see it at the very end of the book as the heavenly city, the heavenly Jerusalem that comes down and takes into it those who are blessed of God and belong to God. And likewise, Babylon in the book of Revelation is symbolic. It's the city of Nimrod, the oppressor and the rebel against God. Revelation, it's symbolic of that spirit, wherever it is found in whatever city or whatever nation, whatever generations of those who rebel against God or seeking to rebel against God, who seek for themselves power and glory, independence of God, who try and make a name for themselves rather than giving glory to the name of God. Jerusalem on the one hand and Babylon on the other. And we read about the beginning of that kingdom in the time of Nimrod. Genesis 10 and verse 10, the beginning of his kingdom was Babel. The beginning of the kingdom of the rebel was Babel. Babylon, we don't find out the end of that kingdom until the book of Revelation. And in Revelation 18 and in verse 1, you can read about the end of the kingdom that Nimrod established. And after these things, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority. And the earth was illumined with his glory. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, "Fallen, fallen is Babylon the great. She's become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit. And the nations have drunk of the wine of the passion of her immorality. And the kings of the earth have committed acts with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich by the wealth of her sensuality." And I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, so that you will not participate in her sins and receive her plagues. For her sins have piled up as high as heaven. God has remembered her iniquities. Pay her back, even as she has paid, and give back to her double according to the deeds. In the cup which she has mixed, mix twice as much for her. To the degree that she glorified herself and lived sensually, to the same degree give her torment and mourning. For she says in her heart, 'I sit as a queen, and I'm not a widow, and I will never see mourning.' For this reason, in one day her plagues will come, and pestilence and mourning and famine, and she will be burned with fire, for the Lord God who judges her is strong." Nimrod, mighty hunter in the face of God, established a kingdom that he thought was independent of God. And they continue to think even to this day that they are independent of God, whether the name is Babylon or whether the name is Russia or China or America. They think they're independent of God. But there is a day of judgment coming in which God will pay them back. And they will find out that they're not independent and they're not mighty and that they have no glory. And which kingdom do we belong to? Colossians chapter 1 and verse 13. Paul writes there again of the good news. He has translated us from the kingdom of darkness into the kingdom of light. Babylon or Jerusalem? That's really the story that we're told about throughout the Bible. The story of Cain and Lamech versus Seth. The story of Ham and Canaan and Cush and Nimrod versus Shem. Noah and Abraham in the city of Jerusalem in the kingdom that acknowledges God as their Lord. And what about us? Where are we today? There is, as we've been singing this morning, room in the kingdom for the work that we can do. Not that the work that we do is not going to get done because we're not there to do it. God is independent of us. We're not independent of Him, but there is room in that kingdom. And we can find a place in that kingdom that ultimately will be rewarded, as we read in the last chapter of the book of Revelation. If you're here this morning and not a member of that kingdom, we encourage you to come as we stand and sing.